and welcome back to the Anti-Diet Club podcast. Thanks for coming back and joining us again. We have an amazing guest on this week. We have Emma Haslam, and she's joining us to talk about IVF, accessing IVF in a marginalized body. And she's going to share with us her story, and it's an incredible story of her own journey and how that has now led to her helping other people access this vital treatment that we should all have access to. This is quite close to my heart, because I have been through fertility treatment with both my children. And, you know, I was at a little chat with Emma at the end of our show, you know, talking about how this journey is very lonely. If you end up finding yourself needing fertility treatment, or even needing to go down the route of seeing if you need fertility treatment, it can be so incredibly lonely. I remember feeling very isolated, and no one I knew, no one in my family, no one in my friendship groups had ever been through anything like this, let alone faced any weight stigma when they'd gone through this stuff. So, you know, this, I think it's just so incredibly important to share this story and these, you know, access to this treatment for people. There's going to be so many people in our audience that this might resonate with, that it might help them. So that's the intention. But it was such a great episode, wasn't it?
Yeah, I always learn a lot through these conversations. It's not, you know, this is what I like about guests who just have very sort of niche areas of their work, and something that I don't have a lot of knowledge and personal or professional experience in. But I similarly hope that if there's anyone listening to this podcast who are in the throes of seeking fertility treatment, or I also want to shout out to the folks who are in a bigger body, who are maybe hopeful one day of starting a family, but are living in fear that their perception might be that their body could potentially be seen or cited as a hurdle or a challenge to conceiving. And I think it's really important to know that there are people out there who will support you, who don't see your body as a problem, and who have the knowledge and the skills, like Emma does, to be able to help you navigate this whole, which seems to me like such a archaic and complicated system with very little evidence to support the kind of bureaucracy that's in place. So it is a hopeful episode. I think I've just positioned it as something really depressing. It isn't.
No, not at all.
It's really hopeful. And yeah, thanks so much to Emma for coming on and sharing her time with us. So let's jump on over to the conversation.
Let's go. Enjoy.
All right, so we are super excited this week to have Emma Haslam join us. Emma, thanks for coming and having this conversation with us. We are really excited to dive into your story around conceiving and starting and growing your family, and how you've navigated the world of IVF in a plus size body. And now, of course, you help other people in the same situation. But let's get back to the very beginning, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself and telling us a bit about, this ride you've been on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm a massive fan of your podcast, as you know. So it's great to be here and to come on and share my story. So, yeah, it's been quite the ride. Back in 2014, I got married. I had a whirlwind romance with my now husband, Adam. And it was, everything was kind of like so perfect in inverted commas, but it really was. And, you know, just as we were kind of getting married, we thought we'll start trying for a baby, unaware of any kind of fertility issues. And I was in a bigger body at the time, but fit and healthy. And, you know, same with my husband. And we began trying to conceive, and sort of 6 months in of kind of casually trying led to maybe 6 months more of not so casually trying. And then after about a year, we thought, you know, perhaps something isn't quite right, because it just wasn't happening. So we went to visit our GP, and the first thing that we were told to do was lose weight. Before kind of any tests or anything happened. But actually, with some further conversation, the GP did agree to do some testing, because I'm quite good at advocating for myself. It's quite a difficult thing to do, as you know, as most listeners and you guys will know. But I just said, well, I at least want to know if there's an issue before we start blaming everything on my BMI. So they did some indicative tests that indicated that there were actually some issues with my husband's sperm and also with my FSH and LH levels, which are like your fertility hormones, were working kind of hard to, you know, working hard to ovulate. And I was experiencing some, now looking back, perimenopausal symptoms as well. And my AMH was very low for somebody of my age. So we got a referral through to gynecology. They did some scans and some more tests and things. And we were told that IVF would be our only option. And in our area at that time, there was one cycle on the table. But we were told that without losing a significant amount of weight, we would not qualify. And that was that. No support to do so, no evidence, no anything. It was just, that's what you're going to have to do if you want your cycle of free treatment. So even though I knew my diagnosis of sort of perimenopause meant that time actually was an issue for us and we needed to crack on with things, we didn't really have any other choice. We didn't have money to go privately. We just thought, right, okay, we need to lose weight. The doctor's telling us we need to lose weight, and off we went. And over the course of 2 years, both lost a significant amount of weight, which made absolutely no difference to my husband's results or to my results. And we were fit and healthy people. And after 2 years, went back, met the guidelines, feeling really kind of happy that we'd done what we needed to do to have treatment, only to be told that actually, in fact, I'm really sorry, Emma and Adam, but the rules have since changed again. And the BMI limit now in this area is actually under 30. So can you go and weigh and lose another significant amount of weight? And I'll be honest, I was completely floored by that point. I mean, it was probably one of the lowest points of my journey with infertility and in my life, I think, because, you know, I'd done everything that I'd been asked to do. Even though I didn't want to do it, and even though there was no evidence as to why I should do it, and the time was just ticking away, and I felt so let down, so angry, and so failed by the system, and I'd lost 2 years of my fertility. And so I think actually I stormed out of that appointment. I mean, that's not really in my nature, but I was just so upset and so angry. And there was no kind of support offered in terms of next steps. It was basically do that and you can have your treatment, or don't and you can't. So left the appointment thinking, well, what on earth are we going to do now? And I just didn't feel like I could or wanted to lose any more weight. And I just felt so guilty and ashamed and all of the things, that this was somehow my fault because I had not been able to, you know, because I wasn't slim enough, in inverted commas, so says the NHS. But then I also knew, and the angsty side of me was like, well, hang on a minute though, if I lived 5 miles down the road, it wouldn't have been a problem. And a year ago, you know, before the rules changed in my area, we would have been treated. It just felt so wrong. And I knew really that it was all about money. But you know, even so, even though I knew those things, it didn't stop me feeling really awful. And, you know, it's already a process where for lots of people when they're infertile, there's a lot of guilt and shame attached to that. And then I think being in a bigger body, it can add to it. And so left the appointment with absolutely no idea what we were going to do next. Really upset, felt really unsupported and just really quite dreadful. But my husband was very supportive and he understood why I felt like I couldn't and didn't want to lose any more weight. And so we began to look into different ways to becoming parents, things like, you know, adoption, surrogacy. And I still felt quite strongly that I wanted to try and carry a baby if I could. and that I wanted to go down the kind of IVF route as much as anybody ever wants to go down the IVF route. But you know, we started to have some conversations with UK clinics. We didn't have any money, but we moved into parents. So we were privileged in the fact that we did have that option to do that. And we began to kind of save and put things like buying a house and all that kind of stuff on hold. And we realized that probably if we cut back, maybe we could afford one round of treatment in the UK. And my, you know, I'd got my BMI down, so I knew that I could have treatment here in the UK. But we had consultations. I just didn't really feel the gel and the love. And we spent about £1,000 in that process of doing that, not to have a clinic at the end of it. And I'd also begun putting weight back on. So I was moving away from that BMI limit again. And it's quite strict, or it was very strict back then. I think things are a little bit better now in the UK, but that just didn't seem like the right solution for us either. And I honestly don't know what made, I think it was me actually that said it, what made me think, let's have a look at going abroad. We're both quite well traveled. We love traveling, and we're probably the kind of people that sometimes zig when other people zag. Like, you know, we, you know, just because healthcare in this country is really good doesn't mean to say it's not really good somewhere else. So we were open to the idea. But actually, back then, the kind of stories that we'd heard, not about fertility treatment, but about people going abroad for treatment, like having their, you know, having a nose job or their, you know, a boob job or their teeth done, were people going away and it going horribly wrong.
Do you mind, Emma, me asking what year was this?
So this was when we first started, let me think, 2015.
Okay. And what age were you then?
So in 2015, I was, trying to work out my age, 35.
Okay.
Yeah. 35.
Just for some context, I'm just picturing it here.
Yeah. So, but we were desperate and we were vulnerable. And I had a BMI that was going out of the UK's limits. And I was sort of done with all of that. And I just needed to get on with things, you know. I was perimenopausal and we'd been trying for such a long time, and I just, we were ready to kind of move forward. So we began to explore going abroad. And I am a natural researcher, I would say, by heart. But we were winging it, absolutely. And we fortunately winged it well and, you know, had a great experience. And, you know, in terms of things like the way that we were treated around BMI was just so different. And I felt like a person, like a human being, and not someone who's defined by size and weight. But I felt like I was in absolutely in safe hands. And, you know, the standard of healthcare was just amazing. And there was no more waiting. I got to take back some control. I got answers and clarity, and I just felt far more comfortable. Plus, it was one heck of a lot cheaper as well. And suddenly things were actually going to be moving forward for us after such a long wait.
How did that feel at that time then? Because you're facing so many closed doors. I imagine that must have felt, you must have felt some hope or you know, something amazing.
Yeah, well, I stopped feeling the guilt and the shame, and I felt, you know, I felt listened to. I didn't feel defined by a computer says no based on BMI. It just felt so refreshing and so different. I felt listened to. I felt like we were given personalized care and attention, like you should. And particularly, you know, when you're paying for it. And it just felt like an absolute breath of fresh air. You know, no one can promise you that you're going to get the happy outcome that we did. But even if I hadn't have had that outcome, I think the fact that I had such a good experience meant that I knew that I'd kind of stretched my budget further. I felt like I'd explored all options and that I had no regrets. So whatever happened, whatever the outcome, that I would have no regrets. And again, that's something I think is quite big for people who are going through infertility. You know, knowing that I could have explored everything and not let my body or somebody else's perception of my body stop me from doing something that I knew ultimately I was healthy enough to do. And actually, who are they to say no, you can't do that. And I knew it was about money. So I suppose when I kind of got rid of some of the emotional side of it and worked through it, I was like, no, this is about money. I didn't want to go to a clinic and have treatment if my weight was an issue, but I knew it wasn't. And they confirmed that it wasn't. And they looked at things far more holistically, which is all I think lots of people in bigger bodies want. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's unsafe, tell us it's okay. But actually, and give us the evidence. If it's not, then, you know, who are you to decide what we do?
But I think you advocating for yourself is and having that ability to know, even in your own mind, that actually you're healthy enough and that, you know, to carry a child and all that, you know, carry a pregnancy and all that kind of stuff is actually quite unique. I think often people are so bought into this idea that their body is wrong, they are wrong, and that actually they don't even question it. I know for a fact that when it was me, I was only very slightly, very slightly over that BMI threshold, but never, not once did I think to myself, oh, okay, yeah, but I'm actually healthy enough to carry and I'm healthy enough to go through this process. My second thought was, yeah, you're right. I'm not where I should be. Like I didn't have that. I wish I'd had that narrative that you had in your mind. It's that sounds like you really had that empowering thought for yourself, even though you've found it hard. I think that's
I did. I mean, it doesn't mean didn't have moments though.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, no, I'm not. Not saying that at all. I just mean that actually to even have that fleeting thought, oh, hang on a minute. No, this isn't, I'm not my body. You know, it's not my body. I'm not wrong. It's about money. To even be able to think that at the time, I think is incredible.
I think the penny drop moment for me, though, was when I went back after losing that significant amount of weight to then be told the rules had changed. So then to be starting to be lectured about BMI when I was just like, hang on, a year ago, this was okay. Mm-hmm. And 5 miles down the road, this is still okay. So do not sit here and tell me, and I was incredibly emotional, angry at this point. Do not sit here and tell me that it's based on safety, because that's not true.
No.
I think all of that kind of pent up feeling and emotion of spending two years of wasting my time and my husband's time in a cycle that was treatment was never going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
And nobody told us, nobody put the hand up and said, oh, by the way, things have changed. Do you still want to be on the waiting list? They just let us go and do it and come back and be hideously disappointed.
And also you've got to consider too, you're saying you were like 35 at the time. The lack of evidence around weight and conception, fertility, and the clear evidence that's in place around age. So you've lost 2 years, which was probably going to hinder your chances of conception more than your weight, and particularly the extra weight that they're saying that you need to lose, and the stress that causes you, and the anxiety and the shame and the blame. It's it isn't holistic. And as you say, that just that thing of like the computer says, we've changed the rules. And I really just hear from you like how unjust that is.
Yeah, so unjust.
So,
you know, while I'm quite a placid person, usually I get to a point and then I've had enough, and that was my point. And it kind of like there was no reason to hold back, because they weren't offering us anything, and you know, it was a horrible, horrible situation. To be in, like I say, I'm willing to listen to evidence and have discussions about weight. I'm not bothered about that. But yeah, it's that holistic kind of looking at things and people trying to hoodwink you into believing it's about something that actually it's not, doesn't sit well.
Do you mind me asking a bit more about, you know, you said that you had to lose a significant amount of weight and then you were asked to lose more and you were just like, no, that's not possible. And when you started to explore clinics abroad and you were saying your weight was starting to increase again, I wonder if you could speak a bit more to like how difficult it was, even though you had this very clear motivation, right, to meet this BMI threshold in order to get treatment. Like, how difficult was it to lose the weight and then also to keep it off? And I suppose what I'm interested in is, have you always been in a bigger body? Do you have a history of dieting? Like, what's your relationship with all of this stuff prior to this point in your journey?
Yeah, I've always felt like I've lived in a bigger body. I was always taller than my friends, broader perhaps. So I think from quite a young age, I felt bigger. But looking back, actually, wasn't. But in my kind of teenage years, I began to binge eat and secretly eat. And I would be in a cycle of kind of going up and down, doing all the things to sort of lose weight. But even then, looking back, I still wasn't in a particularly big body when leaving school, but I always had this perception of myself that I was bigger, and I was always a comfort eater, and that's how I dealt with things in life. And when I left school after my A-levels and went to university, I began to eat more. Different things were happening in my life, and that's kind of my way of coping. So I've always struggled, even if that was a mental struggle at first, and my perception of myself that then became kind of the reality of living in a bigger body, which is something actually, as I've got older, I've become more comfortable with, because I understand now that it doesn't define who you are. It's the least interesting thing about me, hopefully, and it doesn't mean to say that someone is unhealthy, but I did struggle with living in a bigger body when I was younger, certainly in my teens and 20s, I would say, found it challenging.
Yeah, because as Tasman said, as Tamsin said, did I just get your name wrong?
Are we even friends? Like, sorry. You're leaving that one in.
Leave that in. As my co-host, Tamsin, said, you had this kind of awareness where what I really heard you say was there came a point where I was like, no, I'm actually going to defend my body here. I'm not going to see my body as the problem. I'm not going to abandon myself. I'm actually going to stick up for myself. I've done this incredible thing of losing the weight that I was asked to do. And it just sounded like you put your foot down and said, no, actually, I'm not going to have somebody who doesn't know me and doesn't know, you didn't say particularly, but you're saying that you felt healthy, you felt like you could carry a pregnancy, and for that not to be believed or considered, I suppose, and just looked through this lens of weight. I guess I'm kind of astounded by that in a way, because I think certainly with the folks that I work with, it takes a lot of confidence to stay on the side of your body. And to not see your body as the problem, right? That is our reaction. Anytime that we're stigmatized, anytime we're discriminated against, particularly somebody who's felt like they've been in a bigger body, even if sort of technically speaking, maybe aren't, to jump to that place of, yeah, I am the problem. It is my body that's the problem. Mm-hmm. It sits with me, not the system. I suppose we might get onto this in our conversation, but I'm wondering if that's something that you now help your clients around, is stay on the side of your body. You know, your body's not the problem. That kind of emotional support, I suppose, I'm speaking to, in addition to all the practical and logistical stuff you help folks with.
Yeah, 100%. I work with a lot of people who are in bigger bodies. And because, you know, even though I kind of had that quite confident outburst 2 years prior to that, when they told me it was they didn't say it was my weight, but that I had to lose weight for treatment, I just accepted it then. Mm-hmm. And thought, well, this is my fault, this is my problem. But 2 years is a long time to do something. And, you know, it was a significant amount of weight and sacrifice. And, you know, I think it was the sheer anger on that return visit of the time wasted and you know, learning bits in the time I did about actually down the road, they're still doing it at BMI of 35. And being lied to, I just thought, well, they're not going to give me anything, so why not stand up for yourself? But 2 years before that, I was like lots of people and didn't feel I had the confidence to question. Mm-hmm. And I just accepted it because this is what a doctor's saying to me. So a big part of what I do is support clients emotionally, but also help them to feel that they can advocate for themselves and they can question. So one of the things that I do is I give them a list of suggested questions, because I didn't really know what to ask a clinic when I was speaking to clinics back then. And on there are some quite tough questions. Or people say to me, oh my goodness, I can't ask them that, Emma. I'm like, well, you don't have to, but I want people to come away from their consultations going, that is the clinic for me, not that's the clinic for me because Emma suggested it, because I might narrow down the clinics and give them choices, but ultimately they have to feel the connection with that clinic and come away with no doubts in their mind that they're the right clinic for them. And I want people to feel that they can ask whatever they like. And a lot of people who come to me have had very difficult experiences that have led them to coming, you know, to working with me, and have almost, particular people with accessibility issues, people in bigger bodies, have sort of accepted that it's just the way that it is, because it's the way that it's always been. Mm-hmm. Which is so sad, but totally understandable. So part of my work with them is to try and empower them that it doesn't have to be this way and that we can change the narrative going forward. And because I'm in a bigger body, I get it. So instantly, I like to think people don't feel judged, and that, you know, I understand the struggles that people are going through. And the amount of people that will say to me, you know, I know it's my fault because of my BMI, I'm like, it's not your fault. You know, infertility is not your fault.
And access to the services to support you is not your, you know, lack of access to the services. I'm curious to know, and I know the accessibility for this treatment isn't just around BMI, but just while we're on that topic, I'm just curious to know, like, is it not part of the discussion, or are the thresholds higher? How is it more accessible abroad? I'm just curious, is it not discussed at all, or is it just that it's different, or it's different because you're paying for it, or what opens it up abroad as opposed to the UK?
I mean, I believe there are some clinics now in the UK that will treat people at higher BMIs than perhaps when we were looking back then. And there are still clinics abroad that have lower BMI limits. So it's not all clinics abroad. Right. But there are certainly more clinics that have either a flexible BMI limit or a higher BMI limit, that are willing to kind of have those conversations, look at your medical records and history. So, you know how I mentioned earlier on about I felt I was healthy enough to have a baby. I didn't have any medical conditions. I wasn't on any medication. Blood pressure was fine. You know, all the things were absolutely fine. So there's no reason for me not to be able to, apart from down to kind of making a decision around money. So if you're going for an NHS funded treatment, I don't know of anybody that's fought the system and won. Unfortunately, it's very cut and dry, and it's an absolute postcode lottery depending on where you live. And, you know, even at the moment I'm hearing of people not being denied testing based on BMI, or being told that to qualify for treatment they need to get their BMIs down and stay down for a year before they can access treatment, which is a whole other level of like fat phobia. And to deny people the right to find out what's wrong with them based on BMI is just complete discrimination. It's so wrong. It's not happening in every area, but it's happening.
Yeah, it's almost like the dark side of me is thinking, they know that diets don't work. They know that for somebody to suppress their weight, particularly to the levels that you're talking about, that's not going to be a permanent solution. When we look at the evidence, six months after meeting the kind of lowest weight is when it starts to creep back up. And we've had that evidence for a long time, so it's the dark side of me really is starting to think here, they know how impossible that is. Try and keep that amount of weight off for a year is so hard. It's virtually impossible.
And also under those circumstances where you're wanting to, you know, have a family, grow a family, whatever the situation might be, that's stressful as well, like adding that on, you know, and that's just another layer, isn't it, of just, oh, and I've also got to like artificially pull my weight down to a unsustainable low weight. It's just, it just seems like, you say, Gillian, I think I'm with you on this, that the dark side of our brains is just like, they know. They're just,
I know,
you know, playing a numbers game, and it eliminates,
and so it's many all about people elimination. From the
system they can't already afford.
Mm. Absolutely. And, you know, going kind of back to your question. So going privately, you do certainly see kind of across the board in the UK and, you know, and abroad, that the limits will be higher than 30. But in the UK, they don't seem to be as generous as perhaps some other clinics in some other countries. Not all clinics, though, abroad. But certainly there are some real gems that are happy to just have those conversations and not just automatically move to weight is the issue, which is a really refreshing place. And it's lovely when I have clients who are in bigger bodies and they're so fearful of, you know, having these conversations with medical professionals. And despite my reassurances of that it's not going to be like that, until they experience it themselves, they can't quite believe it. And then to see, you know, to hear how they felt treated like people, which it's really sad to say that, because that's exactly how they should have been treated all along. But, you know, to feel listened to and valued, and to have those open and honest discussions, and, you know, not be an immediate blocker to treatment, is so refreshing for people. And that's great. And I love that part of my work.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, in terms of, so getting back to your own story before I ask this next question. So you said that you were successful in the end of conceiving, and you have one child, is that right? Or more?
We've got one little boy. And interestingly, this is another quite important part of the story, and whether or not, so just to start off by saying I wouldn't change anything now, which will make sense in a moment, but I lost 2 years of my fertility because I listened to a medical professional in the beginning that, based on nothing, and went away to lose lots of weight and lost 2 years. And when we had our consultations with the clinics abroad, now interestingly, this wasn't mentioned in the UK and I'm not sure why, but we were basically told we had about a 3-5% chance of it working with my own eggs and my husband's sperm. So while, of course, we could have gone down that route with a limited budget and money that we'd saved up, you know, we couldn't live with my parents forever. We actually went down the donor conception route. And we had a little boy who's actually through double donation. And, you know, I do genuinely mean it when I say that I wouldn't change it, because I don't want to change who he is. I wish for a less complicated story for him, of course. But, you know, at the time, all I could think was, you've lost me 2 years of my fertility, and what difference might that have made? It probably wouldn't have made any difference, but it might. And, you know, that was tough at the time.
Yeah.
Really tough.
Yeah, I can imagine that must be so tough, making those decisions as well.
Yeah, although on the flip side, you know, we had considered surrogacy, we'd considered adoption. Mm-hmm. So we knew perhaps that our path to parenthood wouldn't be, you know, the regular way, in inverted commas, whatever that is now. But it also gave us hope, because suddenly our chances of it working were suddenly so much higher than that. So we knew we had a really good shot of actually, you know, this is probably going to work. Because my oven, as the doctor called it, which is quite hilarious, was absolutely fine. I know, my oven. I mean, they got my humour, but, you know, my oven was okay. So yeah, and on our fourth cycle, third transfer, I conceived twins. I lost one of the twins at 10 weeks, sadly, but then I went on to deliver my little boy, who's now 4 and just gone to school.
And did you have any support around that, all that, everything that was happening, the decisions you were making, the loss, you know, was there support in the UK, support there, support with family?
I mean, I have a supportive husband, I have a supportive family. I'll be honest, and I say this to my clients now, support is so important. What I did was race from one cycle to the next, to the next, to the next, putting everything in a box in the back of my head, making decisions that were not informed, winging it and ignoring things, just so desperate to kind of get to the end result. But then what actually happened, which is no surprise, is that after I'd had my son, I had a brilliant pregnancy, by the way, despite being in a bigger body.
<No problem. laughs> Yeah, I love that. Get that in there, definitely. Absolutely.
But then I got horrific postnatal depression to the point where I did not want to be here. And it was the darkest 18 months of my life. And I believe it was all of the trauma of everything that I'd been through and loss and everything. But I did get some great support. And I was very lucky that when I spoke out, I quite quickly got some support through the NHS, and I had a wonderful therapist who was just amazing. I was very lucky, I think, because I know people can be sat on waiting lists for too long. Mm-hmm. And I had some medication, and I think it probably saved my life. I never thought I was going to be okay again. And I think, you know, my son was the thing that kept me going, but it was a really horrible time.
Yeah. And you've named it right, the trauma of all of that. I mean, IVF in and of itself, out with any of the stuff we're talking about today, is traumatic.
Yeah.
And I mean, Tamsin, and maybe you can speak more to that than I can. I'm not, you know, I'm not a parent, I haven't been through this, but I can only imagine that this whole other layer of feeling like, what I hear from clients is like, I've done this to myself. I am to blame for this not happening, or for a medical condition or whatever it is. And this idea that we've kind of, got ourselves into this position is, which I think is only reinforced by this idea of like doctors saying like, and this is the way to get out of that position that you've put yourself into by gaining weight, is to lose the weight. Like, it's almost like you need to reverse this thing and it's on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is also traumatic, and I'm just really happy to hear that you offer that, not just evidence and not just the practical and logistical support, but as you say, that emotional support of, you know, you've been there, you've done it, you've been through it, and signposting to different professionals along the way, I'm sure as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, could you, the question that I had that I want to come back to is, in terms of, like you said earlier, inclusivity is sort of at the heart of everything that you do. And I wonder, in terms of your access and contacts to different clinics throughout Europe, where, like, does that extend to, I guess, my probably very naive perception of inclusivity in particular areas in Europe doesn't feel particularly positive, or particularly around things like LGBTQ you know, communities and trans communities and disability. Like, how does that what's your experience with that? You know, could you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, sure. Accessibility is extremely important to me, and interestingly, a large proportion of my clients have faced some of the accessibility issues, and others, as well. But there are certainly places in Europe that I would not send clients to who are part of the LGBTQ community or people of colour, because you're quite right, there are some places that are really stuck in the dark ages, and, you know, that community are not going to feel comfortable, or that community, you know, with the laws in certain countries, may not be able to receive treatment. And, you know, I know there's not a one size clinic fits all based on people's needs and personalities. So on that basis, you know, Europe is a huge continent, and within Europe, there are also lots of progressive countries and clinics that are very LGBTQ, you know, friendly. and countries where you would go and hopefully feel comfortable versus the ones that you wouldn't. So this is something that I work through with my clients, because that's very, very important from a feeling comfortable point of view, but also in terms of how you're going to be treated, what that experience is going to be like for you, and where you can have treatment.
Yeah, it's so great that you have that knowledge and that is those sort of awareness of that and the contacts within these countries that, you know, as you say, not one size fits all. I'm sure the different clients that you have, it really is a case of shortlisting, I suppose, what clinics might be suitable, and then and then helping those clients advocate for themselves, ask the right questions, and then have them presumably make contact with the clinics and then see for themselves how they feel treated and supported in order to make that really important choice.
Yeah, absolutely. And knowing that I'm there in the background with them, where they can go, can I just ask this? Can I just throw this out there? Or, you know, I don't know if this is a silly question. I'm like, there's no silly questions. Like, I like think I make people feel like they can ask me literally anything. There's no too much information with me. And, you know, I am there to champion everybody and feel really passionately about it. And so, you know, a lot of these people have had very difficult, you know, difficult experiences. I can think of one same-sex female couple that came to me. And they said that when they went to their doctor, their GP, and to find out about if they could have IVF, she said they needed to have a year of trying first. And they were like, how do we do that for two females? And she was like, well, that's what the guidelines say. And they just left because they didn't know what else to do. And they're like, you know, I mean, that is just awful. Or going to appointments where the doctor has talked to, you know, the woman that is going to be having the treatment and completely ignored the partner, or where they felt perhaps people have had opinions about their sexuality and they've made them feel very, very uncomfortable. You know, so to see people like that go through the process and have a very different experience is great. And I hear some abhorrent things that happen to people that just should not happen.
And I'm guessing now the service that you offer is presumably the service that you wished you had or had access to when you were going through this. If there was only a you sort of, you know, years down the line that could have given you all the tools and confidence and advocacy and knowledge that you have now, I'm sure it would have been invaluable.
Yeah, basically, we were frantically Googling, looking for the support that we've now become. It didn't exist. And we wanted people to know that this was another potential choice for them. You know, having private fertility treatment is not accessible for everybody. And I know that. But for some people, it will be. And actually, for some people, it might then become accessible if they consider moving out of their home country. So I work with clients all around the world. You know, in America, it is even more expensive than, say, in the UK. Australia is very expensive, Canada. So for some people, it might then become accessible. So try to design a service based on what we needed and what we and what people tell us that they need. And, you know, it was really important to us to be completely impartial and take no commission from clinics, because I didn't ever want to be recommending a clinic that I was taking commission from and potentially being swayed by a higher paying commission. You know, I always wanted to know, well, I want to sleep at night, but I always wanted to know that I was always, always thinking in the best interests of our clients and that they could trust us, because why not? Because I'm not taking commission. And instead they, you know, they often get discounts off their treatment as well. So that helps to negate some of our fee, which is great. But yeah, I think making those informed and educated decisions is so important. And we didn't do that. And, you know, having a safe space to be held when you're going through that, whatever that looks like for you. And that not one size fits all. And also we're not tied to any clinic groups. So we can literally, you know, recommend whatever clinic we think is right for people across Europe. So suddenly it opens up so many opportunities for so many people that perhaps they didn't have before.
And as you say, working with someone who not only has the knowledge of what exists abroad, but given people the confidence and the comfort, because I would imagine, as you said right at the beginning, like, it sounds really scary. Like, you hear these horror stories, historically anyway, of other treatment that, having you alongside would just make the road so much smoother. So thank you for coming on and sharing with us, but also thanks for the work that you do. My hope is that there's going to be some people listening to this podcast that take comfort in what your message is, but also in the service that you offer, and hopefully reach out and contact you if that's something that they need, because we need more people to be seeing larger bodies not as a problem to be fixed, right? Just supported in an unbiased way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not sat here saying either that everywhere abroad is safe and fine, because it's not. You must do your due diligence if you're going to go abroad. But, you know, could it be an option for you? Maybe it is. And it may be something just worth exploring. And if somebody has told you that you can't have treatment based because you've got a bigger body, doesn't necessarily mean that that is true. And, you know, I know it's hard to hear that. But, you know, if you are in a position to potentially have private treatment, you know, go and start having some conversations. And I know it's difficult, but don't just accept that that is definitely right, because it might not be. It probably isn't. You know, particularly if it's an NHS type conversation. And it's not the doctor's fault, you know, that they are within those parameters. But I think a little bit more honesty would be better. You know, I would much more appreciate a doctor who said,
we're up against
the
it.
The systems
the
wrong,
system says no, you know, rather than trying to BS you with a load of waffle. I'm not saying every doctor would be the same, they wouldn't, but
and that's where it starts to get really political, right? Like, how it's easier to blame the individual, and we see that not just in fertility, but across the board, how it's easier to blame the individual than to actually look at the systemic issue that we have. That's another episode.
Emma, where can people find you if they want to reach out? Where's the best place to contact you? Obviously, we'll put all your links in the show notes, but just, you know, give people an idea of where you kind of hang out. Are you on social media, your website?
Yeah, sure. So there's a few different places, because I know that not everybody's got money to work with me, and I want to be as accessible as I can to people. And I also know that people aren't necessarily always at that stage yet. They just want to find out a little bit more. So I've got some great free stuff for you. I also have a podcast. If you just search for Your IVF Abroad or click in the links, you'll find it. All about infertility and fertility treatment abroad. I'm on Instagram at Your IVF Abroad. And I also have a blog, which you will find via my Instagram links. And I have some freebies as well. So I produce a few like free guides, like to the step-by-step process of having fertility treatment abroad, because that's something I could not get my head around at the time. Mm. And I was like, would someone just explain it to me?
Demystify it, yeah.
Because I needed to kind of understand that first before I could then move on to the next step. Absolutely. So I've given you guys the link for that. But again, I've got other free stuff in my bio. So Instagram is probably one of the main places, and you can check me out on my website as well, and you can see more about me and what I do. And I hope it's been helpful.
Amazing.
It's been so helpful.
I'm sure it will be helpful to people listening. Definitely. It's been lovely chatting to you and getting to know your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been lovely to be here. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Emma. Bye.
Bye.